A world of magic in Texas. Texas Association of Magicians. T-A-O-M.
Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and it is Sunday morning, and we are getting ready for day three of the Texas Association of Magicians here in Austin. But I'm here at the registration desk for next year, in which we're going to be having our convention in Corpus Christi, and we will be having as our president Mrs. Judy Hollingsworth. Hey there, Judy.
Good morning.
And so you're excited about being a president there next year?
I am very excited. We've got a terrific team put together to bring magicians from all over the world the best little magic convention in Texas. We're going to bring many new faces, magic stars, and everything you expect from TAOM.
And we haven't had it in Corpus for what? 15 years? It's been a long time.
The last one in Corpus Christi was in 2007.
Okay. So it has been, yeah, about 8 years. And this next year, of course, we're going to be competing against San Antonio, and you're more than well aware of that. And I know that you and Scott have worked hard in the past whenever that we had the convention in Houston, and it was a success, and I expect nothing less than Corpus Christi. It should be good then, too.
You're very kind. No, we are going the small route, but we are going the best route, and we have a hotel that fits that description very, very well. It is the Emerald Beach Hotel, and it is on the beach. You walk out the door of the hotel and straight into the Gulf of Mexico. The hotel has amenities that anyone would expect from the very finest resort hotels. And our rates are very, very competitive, and there's tons of stuff for family entertainment as well as the best magic.
Is that going to be still warm enough that time of the year if people should bring their swimsuits so they're going to walk over to the beach?
Absolutely. September in Texas is very
summer, most other places.
It's still summer in Texas, for sure. No, it's definitely going to be a laid-back on the beach magic convention.
And when people are wanting to register, has the website been opened yet?
The website will be open sometime in the next 10 days. It ran into a couple of technical issues, and I've been busy getting ready for this convention, but it's coming.
And what's the website URL?
The website URL is www.taom.org/2016.
Easy enough to find right there. Thank you very much, Judy. Well, I wish you good luck, and I will see you in Corpus next year.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Scott.
For the Magic Word Podcast, that was Judy Hollingsworth. This is Scotty out.
Magic, music, weirdness, and women. TAOM 2015.
Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and we're getting ready for the Order of Willard brunch here today, and that is an organization that is for people who have been members of the Texas Association of Magicians for 25 consecutive years or more. In fact, I'll be getting my 35-year pin here today. That just means I'm an old guy. And one of the things that we like to celebrate, of course, is our heritage, and so we have a wonderful speaker that we're going to be having this morning, and you guys are going to get to hear it too, because I'm going to post this on the podcast after this short little introduction, but it's going to be with Margaret Steele. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Fantastic. And we have here then the book that is Adelaide Herman that you just published in 2011.
Correct.
Is that correct? And you've been studying her for 15 years yourself.
Yes.
So what was the impetus? What was it that you might be talking about this later, but what was it that excited you about?
Well, I didn't know much about her. I knew just the basic story, which was that she took over her husband's act after he passed away, mm-hmm. and performed in vaudeville for 30 years. That's all I knew. But in the year 2000, I was performing for the 75th anniversary for the Oakland Magic Circle, mm-hmm. and a gentleman came up to me after the show with tears in his eyes and said, I thought that Adelaide Herman came back to life just to perform just for me.
Oh, man.
And that was James Hamilton, who's the foremost scholar on the Hermans.
Right.
And I had no idea that I was kind of following in her footsteps, because she was doing the same kind of magic that I have been aspiring to do but 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Wow, and you started to bring that back to life in, like, in your performance you did last evening then with the cornucopia and the flowers.
Correct.
And everything.
Correct. She was the first woman to do that trick. That was a trick by DeColta.
DeColta, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but he did it with spring flowers, as she did also, but I did it with silks.
With
but
silks, yeah.
Same,
I was going to say that was a little
same.
Bit. I was expecting spring flowers, but those are silks. Those are a little bit different, so it's very beautiful.
Well, that was
well done. So.
That was based on a version of the same piece by Julius Sundman, who was a Chicago magician in the 1960s, and he did it with silks. And Eugene Berger clued me into that version.
And so you're able to, it's much more colorful, certainly, from the stage, and I think that you can see that a lot. I was sitting further back, and I could see everything.
Oh, great.
Beautiful. Oh, great.
Great. It's just as complicated to set up.
as you might expect.
I think that's the reason nobody else is doing it.
I understand that. So a little bit later, again, I'm not going to take away what you're going to be talking about on the history of this, but your book had just come out, and if somebody's interested in purchasing the book, they can get this through where?
What's the website? Well, Bramble Books. Which is my publisher, and we have the paperback edition here, the black and white paperback edition, also available on Amazon, but we made a special collector's edition also, hardcover boxed edition, which has color photos in it, beautiful limited edition, and we have a very few of those left available through Bramble Books. The book is, the paperback is $25 and the collector's edition is $100.
Okay.
But we have maybe five of those left. So if you're a collector and you don't have it,
you better hurry.
Better hurry.
How many, you say limited, like what, 500 or how many did you have printed or 100?
Oh, we had 100.
Just 100.
Yeah.
So very limited.
Yeah, very limited.
Yes, I see. And so is this kind of like print on demand as far as
the
paperback?
It is.
And so that those will be
available,
whatever.
Unlimited, yeah.
And now Bramble, that's B-R-A-M-B-L-E, and so is that going to be .com, or where can they
Bramblebooks.com,
find it? Bramblebooks.com.
Yes, or also on Amazon, but for the soft cover.
And again, it's called Adelaide Herman,
Queen of Magic.
Yes. Okay, good. Yes. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Let me ask you a question. The name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So what is your magic word? What is it that's important to you? What's your philosophy of life? What do you... It could be a sentence,
I heard a song by a singer... songwriter here yesterday, and she had this beautiful song called Sing True.
Sing True.
That really struck me that, you know, sing true, sing your heart, sing what's true to you.
Yeah, fantastic. Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the Magic Word Podcast, that was Margaret Steele. This is Scotty out.
Magic, music, weirdness, and women. TAOM 2015.
So our speaker then today is someone who has been studying Adelaide Herman for about 15 years or so and has written the definitive book on Adelaide Herman, published in 2011, called Adelaide Herman, the Queen of Magic. And many of you perhaps saw her on last evening's shows on the Women in Magic that we had. And she had done a recreation then of Adelaide Herman's cornucopia with the flowers, but she had used some silks and everything, and she did a fantastic job, got a great ovation that was well-deserved. And I want you to continue the well-deserved ovation, if you will, please, for Margaret Steele. Margaret?
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me. It's my first time in Austin, and I'm really excited to be here, especially because I'm going to spend a couple of extra days at the Harry Ransom Center researching Adelaide. If I stand here, can everybody see the screen or not?
Yes.
Great. Okay. I just want to correct Scott on one thing. I did not write the book on Adelaide. She wrote the book. It's her memoir that surfaced after 78 years of being lost. So I compiled the pictures that are in it, which are from all the major magic collections, except for Harry Ransom Center. And I also added a lot of other of my own research to it, too, and included all of her magazine articles, too. I don't know if you know she wrote magazine articles. But let's get started. So Adelaide Herman, Queen of Magic, they would say in their day, Herman, the French spelling, but I didn't know that for about 5 years until I had been researching her, so I just say Herman. In June of 1899, a 46-year-old widow took the stage of the Masonic Roof Temple Theater in Chicago to make her vaudeville debut. She was the first and only woman magician on vaudeville. Now, vaudeville presented a lot of opportunities for women at that time, and vaudeville was just beginning to really, really take off. It was made possible by the railroads in the U.S., and every town had a vaudeville theater. that was part of one of the big vaudeville circuits. This is one of the Orpheum theaters. I can't remember exactly where this was, but every town had an Orpheum theater, and there were lots of women on vaudeville. There were dancers, musicians, comedians, male impersonators, quite a few of those, contortionists. Yeah, I know. Animal acts. But, oh, and the great Loie Fuller, she'll figure in later on, the great serpentine dancer. She was very influential in the beginnings of modern dance, influenced Isadora Duncan and many others, and Adelaide Herman. But only one woman magician billed herself as the queen of magic. Look at the size of those billiard balls. She had these tiny little hands, and she also wore rings on every finger, on every toe. So I don't know how she did it. But and as you can tell, you notice where her right hand is. She used a technique known as the bosom servant. And she was, I think, from this and her handwriting, which I've never had analyzed, but I'd like to, I think she was left-handed. She came from very humble roots. Her father was a glass engraver who worked at the glass factory on the south banks of the Thames in London, in Southwark. But her parents were immigrants from Belgium, and she spoke French at home, which was very advantageous to her later on. This is the kind of conditions her father worked in. She had three older sisters, all of whom were married off to glass engravers. That may have been one of her motivations to become a performer. But when she was 3 years old, she was taken to the circus, and she saw the trapeze artists, and from that moment on, she was stage struck. She knew that she was destined to be on the stage. Her parents felt very differently. This was what was going to be her destiny. This was Victorian London, and women, when they became of puberty age, were bound into corsets, distorting them. But Adelaide was actually an extremely athletic kid and a tomboy. I've tracked down a number of relatives, the descendants of her sisters. She didn't have children, but her sisters all had kids. Apparently, she was always climbing trees, sliding down the banister, and when she was about 14 or 15, she sneaked off and started taking dance classes without her parents knowing. It was very hard for her to cover it up because she didn't realize that when you studied dance, it made you really sore. So she came limping home. But she managed to cover it up until she got cast in a show for the London Pantomimes, which did employ working-class children, and she broke the news to her parents. Everybody went to the show, and they were okay with it. And then the Karalfi family Hungarian dance troupe hired her at the age of 16 to travel with them to New York. So she traveled to New York. This is a poster from the Karalfi company, and they were very scandalous because they showed their legs. At that point, it was scandalous even to show your ankles. But she was she left home, and she never looked back. She was a creature of the stage from that point onward. She stayed in New York and formed a dance troupe with a couple of the other British dancers, and she met this man. His name was Gus Edwards. No, not Gus Edwards. Gus, I'm blanking. But he was a comedian, a German comedian. And he pursued her, and they became engaged. And he did a takeoff on a German bumpkin. And he didn't end well. When World War I started, he committed suicide very publicly outside the Yonkers train station with a bullet to the head because his act was no longer popular. But so she did much better after that. She fled. She didn't want to marry him, but he was so persistent that she fled back to London and ended up going with a friend of hers to Egyptian Hall and saw this magician perform, the great Alexander Herman, who was performing for 1,000 nights at Egyptian Hall. And he invited her up on stage and did a trick with her, and she remembered those burning eyes of his. But she thought that was it. He had been on tour with his brother, Compars, his much older brother, Compars, or Carl Hermann. They'd been touring the U.S., performing for some famous people. But they came back, and Alexander was, at that point, just filling houses every night at Egyptian Hall. And Adelaide, in the meantime, joined a trick bicycle troupe. She became the first woman in the first female bicycle troupe ever to perform on stage. And they got hired to go to New York in a company called Schumann's Transatlantic Vaudeville. There she is with her bicycle. And there's the troupe. You can see Adelaide. She's second from the right. So they were all on a ship on the way to New York. And guess who else was on the ship? This man. Now, he was a native French speaker, and he was very taken with this young lady who spoke French, beautiful redhead. He remembered her from the show, and by the time the week-long voyage was over, they were engaged. This is the only photo of them together, their wedding photo. Yes, I would like to find another one, if anybody has ever seen one, but this is the only one I know of. And she began to perform in the act with him. Now, at that point, in those days, the magician's assistant was a boy, and Alexander had performed as his brother's assistant for years, so he taught Adelaide his part in the show and called her Monsieur Alexandre on stage, his name, and there she is in her wig. This is from the Magic Circle collection. There's another picture of her. So she was the little page boy that came on and assisted him. But together with him, they had the idea of why not having her be a lady assistant. She was athletic. She was very daring, as you'll find out. So she became the very first glamorous female assistant. And together, they developed the first Grand Illusion show, the two of them together. And she always got billing. She was Mademoiselle Addie. And you see in this one, she's even got upper billing. This is a poster of one of the acts they did. One of their assistants later on was William Robinson. And he and his wife, alleged wife, Dot, would perform, go back and forth between the Hermann Show and the Keller Show. They were double agents. They were stealing each other's secrets. The black art, of course, was William Robinson's. Notice that Alexander Hermann is dressed in a red devil costume, which he wore a lot. He was Jewish, and he played it up. He said, "I resemble his satanic majesty." His act was hilarious. He was also the first great comic magician. It caused a lot of conflict between him and his brother, Compars, who thought that magic should be humorous, but a serious demonstration. He thought it was disrespectful to have people rolling in the aisles, but not Alexander, as you can see. Dressed in a red satin devil costume for the black art. They toured all over everywhere, and I just wanted to just get an idea of what it was like back then. This is Salt Lake City in the 1880s, and this was what every place looked like back then. This probably looks better than a lot of places. They traveled by rail when they could. Other times, this is Brigham Young. They were entertained by him. And a lot of famous people. This is San Francisco about that time. They performed there a lot. This is Mexico. They decided to try their hand at touring in Mexico. And that was the president of Mexico, Porfirio Diaz, who provided them with a contingent of 50 soldiers, because Mexico was lawless at that time, unlike now. They had a contingent of 50 soldiers to help them defend against the bandidos, but Alexander Hermann also paid off the head of the bandidos, too, so they weren't going to be having any problems. But they toured Mexico with mules. They were their whole show was carried on muleback. Then they traveled all through Central America. I took out a lot of slides of, we didn't need a travel log of, this is Rio. They were gone for more than a year on that tour. They'd go forever. This is Buenos Aires. And when they first started out, They built their show slowly. They used a lot of other acts in their show. They used variety acts, ventriloquists, jugglers. But slowly they got more and more illusions, and Adelaide even did a turn with her bicycle act. She would carry a girl on her shoulders and pedal around the stage with all these bottles on the stage, not knocking any of them over. She describes that in her book. She was really something. She also got shot out of a cannon. This is not the cannon trick, you know, where the cannon's like this high, but you still need a set of stairs to get in it. No, it's not that one. This was a real cannon. They were in Bogota, and they had a circus act in the show that was doing the cannon act, and they left the show, and they had already billed it, and they found out that in South America you have to do what you bill, or the audiences will rebel. There had been a poster artist who had taken a lot of liberties with their posters in South America, and on some of their illusions had painted in a lot of blood on the posters. And they did their show, and the audience stayed behind and wouldn't leave, and they're all yelling, sangre, sangre. They wanted blood, and they really wanted blood. So they had already billed the cannon act, and they thought they would have to cancel the show, and Adelaide said, no, I'll do it. And Alexander was like, oh, I don't think so. But she did. She made herself a costume. Sometimes she would emerge from the cannon with her costume on fire. One time she, who said cool? One time, she did this for several seasons. One time a little boy in Rochester, New York, threw his program into the net right as she would sail from the box seat, bottom of the boxes. They put the cannon up there. She'd sail over the heads of the audience, over the orchestra pit, into a net on the stage. One night, as she was in the air, a little boy balled up his program and threw it in the net, and she turned her head just slightly, and she landed wrong and dislocated both her shoulders. And then another time, she landed on her face, and she thought she'd broken her nose, and that was it. You know, shoulders, she kept going, but not the face. So she retired that, and they put somebody else in the cannon after that, but she was really, really something. They became one of the most famous acts of any kind in the world. They were well known everywhere. They filled houses everywhere. They would perform in opera houses on the night off of the opera. They both had connections to opera. Alexander's niece was a famous opera singer with the Paris Opera, and both of the wives of his brother, Compars, were both famous opera singers, so they were connected in that world. Alexander allegedly even performed in an opera a couple of times. They were very ambitious. They thought really big, and this was a theater Herman had in Philadelphia. He tried his hand at being an impresario, and this was another theater he had at Broadway on 29th Street in New York. He was spreading himself a little thin, though, and it turned out that a lot of times if the acts didn't live up to what he thought, he'd have to go in and do his own show. So that didn't last that long, but he did have his own show. He did the bullet catch. He would do that for charity shows. This was at the Metropolitan Opera House for the Free Ice Fund, because in the summers, before refrigeration, ice was all they had to keep food from spoiling, and poor people couldn't afford ice, so he did this show for the Free Ice Fund. He also, I found out from her memoir, they made tons of money, and they spent it just as fast, and sometimes when they would be someplace and they wouldn't have enough money, like in Spain or Portugal, he'd hire out a bull ring and do the bullet catch in the bull ring and make a ton of money, and they'd be back in business. Adelaide hated this trick. And of course, you know who was setting this up for him and doing it for him, and Billy Robinson, of course. So we know how that ended later on, Chung Ling Su. But Adelaide would lock herself in her dressing room. She would beg him not to do it. And then when he would finish, she would run on stage and throw herself into his arms. Oh, there were the soldiers. They made a big deal about it, of course. This is Loie Fuller. There is a wonderful biography of her. She had this idea. Serpentine dancing, skirt dancing, had been around for a long time. But what she did was she would stand on a box. And she made these long dresses that had poles in them. And the box was over a glass sheets on the floor, and they would shine lights up through the glass. And she would manipulate the skirts. Well, that's Adelaide doing it. She would manipulate the skirts, and it would just look like if it was yellow lights, it would look like she was on fire. If it was pink lights, it would look like she was a flower. It was a sensation. And Adelaide decided to try her hand at it. So she made several dresses and became, this was a little later on, she retired the page boy act after she gained a little weight. And they started using other illusion assistants too. But this is one of her serpentine dances. They were a sensation in the show too. There she is, looking cute. That's another one of them. And she would have, at this point, she's in her, at the picture here, she's in her late 30s, early 40s. Yeah. So they lived like royalty. This is a little earlier picture of her. They lived like royalty. They spent a lot of money. This was her costume for their illusion, Trilby. They were very current. They would use the stories that were popular at the time, news stories. One of their pieces was Escape from Sing Sing, because there had been a famous escape from Sing Sing prison. This was her Trilby costume. She didn't get to wear this with her husband. It had been ordered, and it got delivered right after he died. They carried all their horses and carriages so they could make a grand entrance. They had, at one point, I was told, about 16 rail cars full of stuff, horses and carriages. He also showed racehorses. Show horses. He would go to horse shows as well. They had their own private rail car. It had belonged to Lily Langtree before they bought it. It's hard to see on the slide, but in the center of it, do I have a pointer? It says Herman right there. She describes this in great detail in her book. That's their mansion on the Long Island Sound. They had a lot of acreage, 100 feet of sound front, which they used for their yacht, the Fra Diavolo. Which sat really low, it looks like. Later on, the next owner actually sank this yacht. So, fortunately, that didn't happen. Now, Alexander Herman was a chain smoker. He smoked cigarettes, he smoked cigars, and for about 2 years, he had a terrible cough, a lot of chest pain. They kept going to doctors, and every doctor said, no, it's nothing, and then one doctor said, no, you have smoker's heart. That's what they called it, smoker's heart. And if you don't stop smoking, you're going to die. But he couldn't stop smoking. I guess it was a lot of conflict between him and Adelaide on that. And on December 17th, 1896, they had performed in Rochester, New York. He'd had a tough week. He'd had a lot of chest pain, but he didn't want to disappoint his fans, so not only did he do his shows, he did another show at a reform school, and he went out with all the members of the Genesee Valley Club after the show. Their train pulled out late, like about midnight, and the next day, Adelaide was taking a bath. She had a silver bathtub that pulled out from under her bed. And she was taking a bath, and she pulled aside the curtain, and there was Alexander lying on the bed looking really, really bad. And it turned out that he was having a heart attack, and he passed away on the train as it was speeding down the tracks. It was front page news all over the world. This was his funeral in New York. And Adelaide, she was buried at Woodlawn Cemetery, New York. I've been there many times. It doesn't look like that now. It's all grown up. If you go there, you're going to spend about 2 hours trying to find it. But she was really in a bind at that point, because they were just starting out a tour, and they'd cashed in his insurance policies to finance the tour. So she was stranded in the middle of Western New York with a company of 16 people, all this equipment, all these dates to fulfill, no money. And it turns out that they were, you know, living on a pretty thin margin anyway. The house was leased, the yacht was leased, the rail car they owned. But so what she did, the transatlantic cable was a few years old, so she wired the nephew of Alexander and Compars, Leon Herman, who was in Paris. He had never seen his uncle Alexander's show. He had been touring and working with Compars as his assistant, but he'd never seen Alexander's show. But Adelaide wired Leon, said, come to New York, you're going to take over the show. Alexander had talked about Leon being his successor, but he had never had a chance to train him. So Leon gets on the first boat, arrives in New York. In the meantime, Adelaide starts preparing for her next act, which is going to be the Bullet Catch. And less than a month after Alexander's death, they reopened the show at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York, with Leon taking the role of Alexander. There's their show, their new act, A Night in Japan, and you can see some of the assistants here. Hard to see, but if you look right there, see how that little lady is? That's Dot Robinson. This is a person that will figure in prominently later. This is Adele, Adelaide's niece. Whoops, I didn't mean to do that. And then there's Adelaide, see her? See the big mustache, Billy Robinson? And Leon Herman. Now later on when Adelaide went out on her own, she used this poster, but she turned Leon into a potted plant on the picture. I don't have that one. I wish I did. this is the poster from their third annual tour, third and last annual tour, because Leon and Adelaide did not get along. Leon had a bit of an attitude. Alexander loved everybody. He would talk to anybody. People would come to the stage door. He'd always do a trick for them. He was always doing magic for everyone, everywhere. A lot of magicians remind me of Alexander, but I think of, if you've ever hung out with Paul Daniels, you know, always on, always magic, always comedy, I think that was a lot like Alexander. Leon was different. First of all, his English wasn't good. And at one point, when people would come to the stage door, do us a trick, he said, I do not do magic in the street. Yeah. So, Alexander had been so beloved that the press and audiences really, really tried to give him a chance. And he was a very good magician, very skilled. But he wasn't his uncle. There were 52, same age as Houdini. Yes. There is a letter someplace I rumored to exist, and I think I know who has it, but I've never seen it. Of Houdini, from Houdini, asking Alexander for a job, but that didn't happen. So this is a beautiful poster, but at that point, that was just too much. They split, and Adelaide made her vaudeville debut with a solo act. It was a four-person act, but she was the head of the company. This is so they called their company with Leon Herman and the Great Company, and every poster always had a wreath of Alexander up at the top. So she performed for 30 years in vaudeville, and she, as she aged, she kept reinventing herself. This is an act she did later on called Cagliostro. So it's a pants roll. So she, you know, when you get older, you gotta figure out your gimmick. So hers was to dress as a man and perform as a wizard. There she is with Milton Hudson Everett. He's an interesting character. They picked him up in Georgia in the 1880s. He had nothing but a pair of pants and a string to hold them up. He was hanging around in the theater and they needed a new assistant, to play the role of Boomsky, the foil. And Alexander said, "Who's the best buck and wing dancer here?" And they pointed at this kid. He was like 11 years old. He did a dance for him. He said, "Great, you're hired, but I need your permission from your mother." So Milton Hudson Everett went and found this woman and brought her and said, "This is my mother." And the woman said, "Yeah." And so he's in the show the next day. He didn't ask his real mother. He just went. But later on, he betrayed Adelaide. He stole some of her jewelry, and then she had him put in jail, and then he revealed all her secrets. Oh, okay, we're getting there. She did another act called Noah's Ark with 70 animals in it. Because another thing that you can do and you need a gimmick is put a lot of animals in your show.
She traveled
with 70. Well, vaudeville was full of animals. At one point, she followed a seal act, a trained seal act. They had special hotels and they also had warehouse facilities for animals. And her animals were in one in 1926, a month before Houdini died in September. There was a fire on West 46th Street. It killed all her animals, but it also destroyed all of the memorabilia she'd been saving for 30 years of her husband. Yeah, everything. So that's why you don't see all this Alexander Herman stuff out there. It's very rare because she lost it all. And that's when she decided she had to write a memoir. He was the most famous magician in the world, and it was 30 years later, and already people were forgetting him. So she retired at the age of 74. She sat down to write her memoir. And then in 1932, she passed away and passed into oblivion. It was the height of the Great Depression. Her niece tried to get her memoir published, but she was, you know, nobody even remembered who she was, and it was the Depression. So this was the first book I ever found anything about her on, Frances Marshall's book, and all she gets is a caption and a picture. But in the year 2000, James Hamilton in San Francisco wrote this article about her in Genie, and I was doing a show in Oakland, and I met James. I didn't realize I was following along the same path as Adelaide with my stylistically. So he actually opened all his research to me, and I started out on my own and took it from there. This is just the evidence that she had written a memoir. I'd been looking for it for a long time. There's her niece, Adele, who lived in New Jersey, and I had tracked Adele down as late as 1960. This is the first show of the Society of American Magicians that Adelaide performed on, and I did a tribute to her on the 100th show. So that was really fun. I wrote an article about her, Adelaide Herman, in the SAM. Really interesting. A lot of stuff in there that's not anywhere else. This is her broken wand ceremony that the descendant of Adelaide's niece found in the back of a book that she decided she was going to sell because she was getting married. And that's how she contacted the parent assembly in New York, and that's how the book came to me. That's the niece. That is Janet Collier, and the necklace she's wearing is an amber necklace that Adelaide actually mentions in the book, topaz necklace. So that's my thanks to everybody in the magic history community was so excited about this memoir that I was just overwhelmed by offers of use of materials in the book. So these are all the people that helped me. I have a few copies of it here. On the table. We also have a collector's edition, which we have a few copies left. The book, you can get it on Amazon or through Bramble Books, but I have a few copies. It's $25. I used to work as a musician on Broadway for many years, and I always would like to get a memento of my show, and I always loved the mini posters in the souvenir shops. So I started making mini posters. So I made a mini poster of the this is from the Library of Congress, and I have a few of these too, and when I took one to the Magic History, one of the Magic History workshops, they went crazy over it. So I have a few of those. $5 for those. And I have more at home, so if anybody's interested. But I think that's all I have time for, so thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I have with me the hostess, that is the compeer of last evening's Women in Magic show, Miss Sally Shelley. Hi there, Allie.
Hey, Scott.
Glad to have you here at this year's convention. You attend these a lot. I remember you used to come, of course, with your dad, you know, when he was a dealer years ago.
Exactly. Stood behind the booth, demoed his tricks.
It was a Magic Ranch, or what was the...
All decked out.
All decked out. Okay, yep. That's right.
Mike
and,
Shelley.
Yeah, because Mike had the vests and all that kind of stuff. Now, who did all the tailoring and everything and made all the stuff?
Oh, geez, I have no idea.
Oh, he didn't, or your mom, or nobody? Okay.
He just bought it. Yeah.
Okay, he was like a retailer.
He did the clothing, was like, I think, outsourced, and then he invented the magic himself. So the magic tricks, we used to sit as a family.
I see.
And like glue the pieces together and assemble.
And that's what you did then.
Yeah, kind of, exactly. Okay.
I got it. He was the front and the face of the family, and you were kind of back there doing all the work.
Exactly.
He's not going to listen to this, so.
No. <That's>, he can't deny the truth anyway.
And
so.
Does he still work as a dealer?
He does. He does
online
the larger conventions. So he went to Blackpool, and he'll probably go to the next FISM. Mm-hmm. But, of course, he's cutting back. But, yeah, he still does the big ones.
How many years? It's been 30 years or something?
Oh, at least. Yeah. Every bit of that.
And where in Florida is that?
So he's based in Boca right now.
Okay, yeah. And are you living in Boca? Or you live in New York? Because you're, as a flight attendant, you're kind of going back and forth between New York and Paris. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay. So I was telling people last evening when you were talking about this as part of your routine, I said, she really is a flight attendant. Really? She is? I said, well, can't you tell?
People do not believe me, Scott. I try and give them the information during the show, and they're like, oh, you're a really good actress. And I'm like, no, I'm not acting. I really, really, really am. The act was born on the airplane because, I work the night flight.
Yeah.
Everybody goes to sleep.
Yeah.
I'd pull out the bar cart, dump out the safety information kit, and at night, the window in the back of the plane acts like a mirror. So I would start with
practicing in a mirror that is fascinating.
Yeah.
And you had a long flight to get over to Paris or wherever you're coming
back. 7.5 hours.
And you had to be awake all during that time. You can't take a nap when everyone else is.
Right. More or less.
Yeah. Because when they're ringing that bell saying, hey, you know, come pick up my barf bag.
Dang.
Yeah. Now, as you were developing that act, is that something that you then did for or still do for the passengers? I mean, I know, for example, Southwest always has like a fun thing and they're always joking and everything, but all the other airlines seems like are more serious.
So my airline certainly has a more conservative approach to things.
And policy.
So if it's a special flight, like a charter flight or a refugee flight,
you
then I'll definitely do something for the passengers.
Mm-hmm.
I am trying to avoid an 8-hour show across the ocean while
once
you're,
I know
working,
you're a magician.
And then you're working. So that was like, you know, your first few flights, you're like, oh, I'm going to do this. And you're like, whew, this is like double time.
Yeah. Have you ever had a situation in which there's been a child or somebody who's been crying or had a situation in which that, let me diffuse this or, you know, show you a little magic and kind of lighten the situation?
Yeah. Do you know what I use? The little squeakers that you can find, like at Bob Littles or something like
that.
Put
in your mouth, huh?
Yeah. And so then you just like push their nose and it squeaks and they're like super confused. Or I tell them flat out, I say, now this is a no crying flight. You are just not allowed to cry on this plane.
Anywhere.
You can cry at home, you can cry at school, just not on the airplane. Those are the rules. And they just kind of look at you dumbfounded. And then, like, oftentimes they take you seriously. They're like, oh, well, the lady said I'm not allowed to cry.
Yeah,
so.
And the parent could tell the child, hey, listen to her.
That's right.
They'll put you out the window.
No
crying. Plenty of room on the wing.
Yeah.
And so you get to kind of play with them. And also I remember seeing you perform your close-up show then as well at Abbott's Get-Together before, and it still has the same kind of general theme. And in developing those, I think it's, no one has your kind of, no one has your personality, but also, I guess, your thing. I've never seen anybody do something with an airline theme like this.
So as far as I know, I'm the only airline-themed magician, but I just remember as a child going to the lectures, like starting at 7, 8 years old, I would go with my dad, and I remember they always said, like, oh, your magic is supposed to come from within. Your magic is supposed to be an extension of your personality. So
I guess that just really hit home for me.
Yeah.
And again, you're sitting at 35,000 feet in the air, so my resources are limited. I knew I wanted to practice magic, so why not just start exploring with the items I had around me?
And yeah, so peanuts and drinks and whatever else
and,
you have.
And before I knew it, an act was born. It was not a deliberate, oh, I'm a flight attendant, and therefore let me create a flight attendant act.
Yeah.
It was like a, by default,
yeah,
this is what happened.
You found your personality.
Yeah.
You know, 35,000 feet in the air.
Exactly.
That sounds like a title of a movie.
Yeah.
I found myself in the air.
Okay, so you'll produce and...
and so in developing that, have you got some other ideas and things you're working on then now? Or are you still coming up with ideas? Or you feel like, okay, I've got an act?
I feel like the basis of the act is firm,
yeah,
but I have other ideas that I would like to incorporate into the act,
mm-hmm,
because a lot of people have seen this, and so I think it's important to stay topical with your jokes and to continue to update your material,
mm-hmm,
but I think you have the flexibility of doing that as a flight attendant, because you're like, oh, well, this one time in XYZ city, and boom, your plane is, or your plane, your passengers, whatever, you can take them on pretty much any direction you want, or,
mm-hmm,
oh, look what happened on this layover. And you can set the context of your trick,
mm-hmm,
accordingly.
Yeah.
So I'd like to continue to keep the character, but to expand the act, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I also like the idea that rather than a card trick, you're talking about destinations, because the play on words that I think is very thematic and plays well.
So I'm just going to tell you that with that trick, the flight attendants were as instrumental as the magicians were in creating that.
Oh, really?
There's another example where it was late at night and I had the concept and we pulled out the magazine that you find in the back of the aircraft,
yeah,
and we spread out the map. And one flight attendant was writing all of the cities that were actual, like, mm-hmm, names, like, you know.
Hungary.
Yeah, exactly. And so we brainstormed as a group of flight attendants, and
mm-hmm,
that story was written,
yeah,
by flight attendants.
I like that. It's kind of like Bill Malone's...
Sam the Bellhop.
Sam the Bellhop,
yeah,
kind of a thing, yeah. But talking about the cities, I like that idea, certainly, because it takes out of the realm of being a card trick and everything, too. But there's so many other things. I was thinking, you know, like with the magazine, doing a magazine test or something, which...
With the duty-free magazine.
Yeah.
That's one idea,
yeah,
I'm playing,
yeah,
with right now. I,
yeah,
really am a big fan of Chad Long's Spineless. I think that, mm-hmm, has a lot of potential.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really great. Well, listen, I appreciate you being here, and that I think it's wonderful what Trixie has done, of course, of having women as being pretty much a theme of this, and that it's been predominant and throughout here. You did a great job of being the compere for last evening's show then as well. The name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. My question then to you, Ali, is what is your magic word? What is your philosophy of life? What is it to you that's important to you?
Look,
even in that sentence, it could be a phrase or...
Look, I just think you have to enjoy what you do is the,
yeah,
bottom line.
Yeah, perfect. That's all I wanted to know.
Well, thanks so much
Thank
for having me, and thanks to Trixie and TAOM. It was great to be back here, and I'm looking forward to enjoying the rest of the convention,
yeah,
with you and the rest of the gang.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Cheers.
For the Magic Word Podcast, that was Ali Shelley. Scotty out.
Magic, music, women, and women, TAOM 2015.
Hi, this is Kent Cummins, and I just wanted to say, wow, it's so important to keep the history of magic alive and to preserve the memories and the things that have happened. And I really appreciate the Magic Podcast.
Magic, music, weirdness, and women, TAOM 2015.
Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I have the current president of the Society of American Magicians, Mr. David Bowers. Hi, David.
How are you today, Scott?
Fantastic. Glad that you are here. Is this your first TAOM?
This is my first TAOM.
What do you think?
I really, really have enjoyed. Everyone has made me feel so welcome.
Oh, good.
And I don't think it will be my last.
Have you enjoyed the shows?
What I have enjoyed,
okay,
the shows.
So it's not just the people, it's everything else.
No, it's everything about the convention. They announced earlier that it was a family convention, and you know what? It really is a family convention.
Yeah.
Everybody knows everybody. Everybody talks to everybody. Makes it very, very comfortable.
In that regard, do you feel like an outsider coming to someone else's family reunion, or do you feel like you're part of the family immediately?
I have felt like I've been part of the family immediately. I have not felt like an outsider at all. Everybody's just been so gracious. That,
yeah,
they I'm their, I guess I'm their, either their weird uncle or their adopted brother. I'm not sure which.
I understand. I've often wondered about that. Whenever the people come in, you know, all the conventions will advertise and say, you know, we're the friendliest convention, we're a family convention, we're open to everybody or whatever. And for the most part, everyone is. However, once I'm there, I feel like they're cliquish, you know, and they're within that clique, and I can't really get in because I don't know them. And it's not until after you've attended that convention for a few times that you start to know a few people, and then you get in with the clique. Here, it sounds like what you're saying is you feel like immediately that you have reached acceptance.
And I have, and some of the conventions I've been to do fit the criteria that you just described that are clicky, and you have to go three or four times before you're part of the in group.
Yeah.
But here, I haven't, from day one, I haven't felt that. I've felt very, very welcome.
That's great. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. What do you think about the organization of the, how well it's organized?
Well, I'll tell you, the one person that I really, really am impressed with this year, and I'm sure it would be every year, who's the president, is Trixie. She has just worked so hard. I've just seen what she's been doing and talked to her, and she's worked so hard, and I'm sure that's true of every president when they plan this and put this convention on. So
yeah, you can see that the passion the proof is in the pudding, you know, and this pudding has a lot of passion that she's put into it, and it's been very successful.
And, you know, I think that's what makes it such a great convention, because of the passion of the people to make it good, to make it fun, to make it interesting, to make it very, very enjoyable. That passion comes through to people as they come in.
Absolutely. David, thank you very much. It's good seeing you since FISM. I know that you're traveling all about. You've got, where's your next convention to go from here? Are you going?
Well, next month we're doing a mini magic summit in Indianapolis, a council meeting in November in Nashville. In January, I'll be a week in New England and a week in Omaha, Nebraska. And in February, I'll be in Blackpool, England.
Okay. So, a lot of things planned between now and next year's convention. And the SAM convention will be in
Indianapolis. We've sort of switched times with the IBM convention.
Yeah.
The IBM convention is going to be early over the 4th of July.
Right.
We're later in July next year.
Yeah. Well, good luck on your continued time of office, and I hope all goes well.
Well, thank you, Scott. I enjoy talking. Every time I see you, I enjoy talking
to you. It's my pleasure indeed. That's why I like the corner. You're a great guy to talk to. Thanks a lot. From the Magic Word Podcast, that was national president of the International, or the Society of American Magicians, Mr. David Bowers, and this is Scotty L.
Magic, music, weirdness, and women, TAOM 2015.
Scott Wells, MagicWordPodcast.com. Hey, Peter.
Hey.
How are you enjoying the convention?
Oh, it's a fabulous convention.
Is this the first TAOM to actually be
here? It is the first TAOM.
I know we've had some other guys, you know, like John Carney and some other guys who have actually performed here and attended a lot of these conventions. Great guy. How'd you like his lecture today, by the way?
Oh, it was a great lecture.
Yeah.
It was fabulous.
Got a lot out of it?
I actually do. We talked about this a little bit in the podcast.
And I think people who listen to the podcast regularly will listen to our extended version later time. Yeah, just how about a Bud Light? Be great. Or a Shiner Bock if they got it.
Over there. Popcorn.
Okay, and some popcorn, too. She said she'll have popcorn. And a Shiner. That's right.
In that order.
And so, anyhow.
Yeah.
Hey, Chip, come on over here. That's why you say hello. Just say hello. That's okay. Chip or Merrill.
Hello, everybody. Hello.
You've been enjoying the convention, too. Just real quickly, just getting a recap. So it's
You're talking to my highlight.
Wasn't Peter Gray?
You're talking to my highlight. No, this is all true. He's being humble, but this sure you're out there listening. I actually came here to see Peter Samuelson, and I got to hang out with him for an hour. And when I go to New York, we're going to have lunch. And I'm just telling you, it's been a wonderful convention for me with all my friends. And,
isn't it great?
It has been wonderful. The girls kicked it. The girls did good. The Friday night show was good, and tonight we're here to see our friend Ray. So
I think you're missing
something really nice. That's all we're going to tell you.
Trixie turned it on, I think, with all the women that she had, you know, that really kind of highlighted.
And they were
the
all good.
Two were women, and so
absolutely.
I thought, it turned out to be
absolutely.
Pretty, really,
it was,
really
it was a big. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Stan Allen today, and I told him that she hit it out of the park.
Yep.
And he said, you know, every time you just do something that specialized, he goes, it's hard to do. He goes, but what you're telling me sounds like they really did it right. I said, there was lots of variety, and I said, it was really, really good. So thanks for talking to me, Scott. But
okay, Chip. Nope, yeah, that's okay. I just wanted to say hello because everybody's passing through. We're actually right now at Esther's Folly, getting ready to see Ray Anderson.
I am really excited.
That's right.
It was years ago that I've been here to see Ray work, and it's one of the highlights. It's part of the reason I actually decided I really wanted to come.
Yeah, to see Ray again
here in Austin. Yeah, not just do the TAM, but to do it here in Austin. It's really exciting.
Yeah. This is a weirdness capital, and they revel in it.
Great.
And it's a good kind of weird.
Yeah.
my good friend Brent Henderson actually had me come in a couple of years ago to do some Magic of the Manor.
Oh, that's right. About
exactly.
That.
It was a wonderful, wonderful event. And part of the highlight of that was meeting up with Bob Stenzel. The other highlight of that was being here at Esther's Follies and meeting up with Ray. So this is just, oh, boy, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to
it. Get your popcorn and beer and you're ready
to.
That's right.
I'm all set to go.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
My pleasure.
Okay. That's Peter Samuelson for the Magic Word Podcast. Scotty
L. Music, weirdness, and women. TAOM 2015.
Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast.com. And I'm here then with a person who is definitely falls in the category of the women. Because we've had magic music, women and weirdness, and that you are
so
the queen of the women.
Women.
That's right, and magic as well, because I don't see you as being weird, but you had good music, you know.
There.
So you have had the whole package together. You know, it's a little bit weird, some of the things that you did, because you defied physics with things you were doing. I have with me, I'm sorry, Jade is here, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yes,
hello.
It's Jade.
And glad to have you. Have you enjoyed the convention? This wasn't your first TAOM. I remember you were in San Antonio, I think.
Was it 2007? Somebody was just saying.
That's about right.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten. Yeah.
Was there another one? Fort Worth? Was I at Fort Worth? Third one, actually.
Yes.
I just remember.
And you're performing every time. I mean, you don't ever come and hang out, which you should do. You
know? Oh, really?
Because, well, you can tell by how friendly this convention is.
Oh, I know. This is a great little convention.
Yeah, it's really kind of a family type of a thing. And, you know, I was talking with someone earlier, and they said, yeah, you know, a lot of conventions will advertise themselves as being family and friendly and everything, but they're clickish. And here, I think that everyone is much more welcome.
No,
and do you feel like that you're
absolutely
at home and
I
you
have
enjoy
to
it?
Say, everybody is so friendly and easy to talk to and willing to open up.
Yeah.
So I love that.
You've been working a lot at the convention, I mean, a couple of different nights and everything, but what have you had time to see that you've enjoyed about the convention?
The dealers are great.
Well, thank you.
Like
I was a dealer chairman.
Oh, yes. All right. Good job.
Thank you.
The shows in the evenings were always great.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed them. We had top-notch performers.
Yes, we have had.
And some of the people I haven't seen in a while, and we have new talents.
Mm-hmm.
I heard about the new winners.
The cool people.
Yes.
Are.
Yeah.
Hello.
There you are.
I haven't seen Jay Scott Barry forever, and here he is, right?
Hello, Jay. Yes.
Hello.
You can chat here then as well.
Yeah. Glad
absolutely.
And so he was one of your favorites also that you had.
Absolutely.
To have well.
Come on.
Well,
it's
why
everybody's
not?
Favorite.
No.
Oh!
What's not to like?
Huh.
Or to love?
No.
Jay,
stop that. Stop that.
Well, we got a romance going on here. You know?
We're having a party here. So let's put this in context.
That's right. It is early in the morning, though, right now.
Yeah, we're having a great day.
It is? Oh, my God.
What a fantastic...
Cheers over here.
Cheers. What a fantastic convention.
So tell me about also working with Penn & Teller, Fool Us. That and don't leave, because I want to ask you some questions also then, Jay, but did Johnny Thompson call you, or did you contact them? Who contacted who and how this come out about?
Johnny called me.
Okay.
I was working the castle, and he said, would you like to be on the Penn & Teller show?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this is a joke, right? I said, yeah, of course. And then he says, well, all right. I'll give them your name.
Yeah.
So I don't hear back for a few days. And I said, Johnny, are they interested? I don't know how long these things take. And he says, well, I'll get on it. I'll ask them.
Yeah.
So like within 2 or 3 days, they email me and says, oh, yes, we're very interested. Would you be interested? Blah, blah, blah. And I said, yes, of course. And so there was a waiting process.
Yeah.
Where they had to screen through, I don't know, there were a lot of people that were interested in being a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So after, I don't know, maybe a month's time, they got back and they said, oh, congratulations, you've been chosen to be on the first season in the U.S.
Yeah, okay.
to be one of the performers.
Yeah.
I said, great. So I didn't know how difficult it was until I heard that there were enough performers to fill up 2 seasons and more.
Wow.
That they had to.
Trick selection. You know, then that comes to what that... My question would be, how do you go about finding out what your trick selection is?
I know Jade.
Steve Daly knows Jade?
He's known me since I was a kid.
So I have a question about trick selection.
Okay.
So how did you go about deciding that you were going to be doing the thumb tie? I mean, of all the things, I mean, when Johnny called you, did he have something in mind, or did he say?
No, I found out later. He says, I just assumed you were going to do something from your Chinese act. But the truth is, after I did the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson,
yeah.
I wanted to go back and do the thumb tie with Craig because he's just such a fun guy.
Is he really? I wondered about that. I mean,
yes.
He seems very genuine on television, and so he really is that kind of a guy.
Absolutely. Would never put you down. For me, I felt like he was a bit like Jonathan Ross. Have fun together, promote the art, no way in putting down the art form that we do. But they were not interested, so that was always just in the back of my head. I wanted to do the thumb tie. I don't think most magicians know that I speak.
Well,
yeah.
Interesting, yeah. Okay.
They always just book me for the Chinese act.
I guess they think of you as like being William Robinson, you know? I mean, that you're Chung Ling Su, you know?
I don't know. I suppose.
The silent conjurer.
But I have always been doing the thumb tie. I've done it for like 25 years. Nobody in the magic world really knows.
I think what's really a great thing is whenever you do a costume change, and not just that, but a whole character change. When you let your hair down and you change, it's like, okay, this is completely different character. It's like, you know, the curtain is closed and it's open to a different act.
Oh, yes.
You know, I love that. And then it's like, okay, well, she is talking, she is speaking English, and it is an American act, you know, kind of a thing. And
I enjoy, very
inspiring.
You know, the people that hire me, I tell them, you know, you're not hiring just one woman. You're hiring two for the price of one.
You know, I think it was John Carney or Danny Archer were talking about having characters. Because whenever that, if you have more than one character, you have more than one opportunity to come back and work for that same client.
That's true.
So if you develop some sort of a character. Have you been working on other kinds of characters or other kinds of things that you do?
Well,
or?
You know, I was talking with Bob Fitch, and I so admire the guy.
Yeah.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But I said, I want. What's interesting on stage for people to see is to see dimensions of a persona.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the same old person throughout the show, 1 hour show.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to have depths.
Yeah, yeah.
And because that's a reflection of human beings. We are multifaceted, multidimensional. And so I told Bob Fitch, I said, my next character, I would like to create her to have more of an emotional impact, to have a connection with the audience in a heart-tugging way.
And so do you bring that idea to him and then he develops a character for you, or do you take a character and he kind of chips away at that?
Well, I don't know, actually.
Okay.
We were just talking at the convention. I've never met him before. This is my first time.
Oh, really? Wow, okay.
I've heard of
his name.
So
you've not attended his workshop or any of that stuff?
No, never.
Hmm.
But I have to tell you, before I went on stage on Saturday night, of anybody in the audience, I said, oh my God, Bob Fitch is in the audience. What do I need to change before he sees it?
You know, it's funny you mention that because I heard in his lecture and he was talking about certain things, and I was giving a mini lecture during the thing we had on Saturday, and one of the things he was talking about was finishing your sentences on a high note and not letting your voice kind of trail off at the end of a sentence, and so this way that you still have good impact. Because a lot of times the emphasis of a sentence is the last word or two, and if you trail off, then the point is lost, number one. Second of all, that you are holding someone's attention for a while, finish that sentence, then look to another person and not just scan the audience going back and forth. And I tried consciously, after I'd heard both of those tips, to do that in this mini lecture. I thought, well, this is the perfect time to try this, you know, just so subconsciously that was what I was thinking, you know, about trying to do that.
I am so with you because I attended his lecture as well, that I started thinking, okay, wait a minute, for my thumb tie, am I looking at the people?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Scanning or am I holding their attention?
I don't know. But
you
know what? At the show, it was too sudden. I didn't have time to really go through it.
Yeah, process
so it. I was just doing what I normally
do. Yeah. Yeah.
And he said it was fine. So
I thought it was fine. Yeah, yeah. It was. You know, another idea, it seems like I recall that Jeff McBride was talking about where that you will hold attention of different people in the audience, where that if you're holding something and you start, I will talk to you and be holding a card or something and you, and then I'll, or maybe it's Vito Lupo. I forgot. That's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you're looking at someone else, and so you're still holding that person's attention, and then when you hold it back to them, then you move your head to someone else to talk. Was that Vito? Was that
Jeff? That's Vito.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, right on. all great suggestions and great artists, masters of their own art.
Yep. Now, you've had a beautiful act and you've been doing it for many years. Have you been tweaking that, adding some things, or have you got some, I mean, you've been successful with this around the world? What are your...
Well, the thing about the Chinese act in my mind is kind of like a finished product. I can add to it, extending, creating the new characters, the different dimensions. But I don't want to change the Chinese act.
I don't see why you should. I just didn't know if there was something else that you were working on. I mean, like with the thumb tie, that you have this new character, and you were just mentioning then, of course, that you happen to have someone who is going to be more... And so with the new act, I was thinking you might be developing something a little bit new with your new character. You were, of course, mentioning about with Bob Fitch that you were going to try to have something that was having more of a range of emotion. But have you got something in mind? Or are you descripting this? And how do you normally come up with that? What's your creative outlet? How do you create? Do you dream about things? Do you read things? You listen to music? You just think it up? You do some brainstorming with friends or all of the above?
You know what? Bob Fitch and I were both into imagery. He said something about my couldn't restore ribbon. He says that V, when I step on the ends of the silk, he says, that's a strong image.
It is.
Maybe you should duplicate it somewhere else or a different image. But the thing is, even my Chinese act is full of images because I hold my poses.
Like a tableau, the way that Le Grand David always had. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think, so the way I do it is, I am inspired by art, by performances, and then I think, oh, if I see a dance number somewhere, and I say, oh, maybe I can change that and make magical and something else happens. And then put a storyline on it.
Yeah.
Just act it out.
Thank
so you. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, just...
See how it goes.
Yeah. I know. It's all just creating, dreaming.
Right.
You know how it is.
I do know. Well, I know it's late. You got to pack, and it's, I should say it's early. It's almost, 3 o'clock or something.
Oh, my God.
So I tell you what, before we close, the name of my podcast is called the magicwordpodcast.com. So my question is, what is your magic word? What is your philosophy? What's Jade's belief in life? What is it you live by? What do you wake up in the morning and say, this is what gets me out of bed and keeps me going? It could be a phrase, a sentence. I mean, what's important to you?
I think remember the things that matter most in life. It's not the money or the fame, because those things go away.
They're fleeting.
They're fleeting. Family and friends. That's always my grounding point.
Grounding, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Just be happy.
Don't worry.
Yeah. That's really it. I wake up in the morning and I don't think about... I had people come on up to me and says, we're like such a high-ranking performer, but you talk to us.
Like a real person,
And I said, well, I'm not curing cancer. Why should I have a big head about what?
Yeah.
Just because I'm on stage.
Yeah.
Means nothing.
Yeah. It's a job that you love.
Yeah, and lucky me, right?
Yeah, they always say that if you're doing something you love, you're never working a day in your life.
I love that.
You know, that's right.
So lucky.
Jade, thank you very much for speaking with us for the Magic Word Podcast. That was Jade. This is Scotty L.
Music, weirdness, and women. TAOM 2015.
All right, so now we're back over after I've had a talk with Jade. We'll carry on a little bit then with J. Scott Berry. And Jay, you've been an outstanding star of the convention. This has really been just a star-riddled convention. And I say star because some people who may be known or unknown, but I'm talking about those even who are... Because it's also been stars of tomorrow. There have been a lot of young people who have... And contestants. We had just a fantastic contest in stage and close-up. And as a result of that, I think we'll be seeing a lot of people in the future who may not be as well-known, but I think made this convention, really an outstanding one. But you've been one of the people doing that as well. And you showed a lot of range then also this evening's party, which you were singing a song, which a lot of people didn't know that you had such a great voice.
Oh, thank you. Scott, I agree with you. This has actually been an amazing range of talent on this event, and I'm extremely impressed with the organizers and yourself and Trixie and the others who drew together really a full spectrum of the art, mm-hmm. from grandmasters, from up-and-coming, great close-up artists, female magicians, just truly an outstanding cast.
Right. Yeah, it has been. And what number TAOM is this for you? Is this your third?
My second.
So it's only your second?
Only my second.
Where were you at the other one, do you remember?
Tyler. Okay. I think it was in 93.
It was in the 90s.
90, yeah. Yep. So about a little over 20 years ago.
That was the one in which...
Markham stepped off the stage. Everyone remembers that.
That's the one. And into the orchestra.
Into the orchestra. It was like one, two, three, off the...
Yeah, they just introduced him. It was the beginning.
And none of us knew if it was a gag. Yeah. We all waited. There was this great pause. And then we finally realized... That wasn't a gag.
And Gloria, his wife, was sitting right behind me, actually, at the time, and she knew that something happened. Because my gosh. And everyone was laughing. And she said, that's not a joke.
He disappeared. I mean, it was just this dark edge.
You're exactly right. One, two, three, he was, like, down in the pit. Yeah. And apparently the lights were pretty bright. Fortunately, he didn't break anything or wasn't bad. Well, I remember that you were lecturing and had longer hair and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. Times have changed, you know.
Indeed, for all of us.
And fashions for all of us, absolutely. Yes. So what has been one of the outstanding things or things from this convention that sticks out that, like later, we were talking about Markham was the one that you'll remember from the title convention. What about this convention? What is your thing that people take away and remember?
Well, I think everything has their... It's an individual thing.
Of course it is.
I mean, for me...
When you were a dealer, lecturer, performer, and everything...
Yeah. I think it's always about the connections, the individual people we meet. And there's been a number of them. But specifically, I had some really quality time with Bob Fitch.
Yeah.
It's the first time I've ever actually been able to sit in on one of his lectures.
Yeah.
Because as a performer and dealer and everything, you often miss other things happening.
Yeah.
And so I was able to sit in and actively take part in the lecture.
Uh-huh.
And then last night, spent a good hour or more with him just chatting, brainstorming, hearing his stories.
Yeah.
And he's one of the people that I've always looked up to.
Yeah.
And this is this amazing lineage of magic where, mm-hmm. you know, it's this sharing the stories that then we'll pass on to others.
Right. Yeah. I think that is important. But it's been overall a really good convention. And talking with Jay a little bit earlier, this was the first time that she'd had an opportunity to meet Bob Fitch then also. And he's done
it was
a great job. And so, speaking of Jay, good night,
it was a
good morning.
Surprise.
Okay, yeah. And he did. He had a workshop that he gave before, and I think that was kind of neat. This convention was bookended, if you will, with a workshop, one with Bob, and then on Monday is going to be one with
John Carney.
Yeah,
exactly. And another modern master of magic.
Exactly.
It's as you say. It's this riddled with incredible, impeccable performers.
Let me also mention Ray Anderson this evening at Esther's Follies.
Oh, yes.
Now, have you seen Ray before, or is this your first experience seeing him?
No, I have not.
What did you think of Esther's Follies in general?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
I thought the entire setup was just... I was surprised they said this is going on all the time. I mean, what an absolute gem of a show.
Yeah, been going on for 30 years.
Genuine vaudeville, in the sense of true variety,
and
variety act.
And topical.
Original, fresh, funny.
Ripped from today's headlines.
A little body,
yeah.
You know, just right at that edge to make it, you know, very popular in the sense of, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, this evening, it was interesting also, the finishing party, in which we had a real variety. We had a guy who was dressed up like a World War II vet, tap dancing
all the way to pole dancers.
To pole dancers,
and,
that's right.
And very fun.
That's
all
right.
In the spirit of just fun.
Right, yes. But David Hyrer was sitting next to me, and he had said, you know, I think it'd be kind of interesting to have a variety act sometime with magicians with their other skills,
mm-hmm.
Whether like they're singing, playing music, whether they're, I don't know, whatever their skill might be.
We often overlook those. Michael Close is obviously a brilliant magician and also
music.
A fantastic piano player.
Yeah.
And a number, Dick Zimmerman, also one of the great jazz players in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't always, you know, think
associate
of that. Exactly.
But on the same token, there are people who buy their CDs, you know, Mike Close and for Dick Zimmerman, who know them as musicians, don't know they're magician either.
That's right. Yeah. I've been interviewed as a musician and singer with literally the DJ says, oh, you know, there's another guy who's named Jay Scott Berry who's a magician. Yeah. And I have to say, yeah, he's my evil twin, or pass it off as a joke until I finally admit that it's me. That's
I think that's a funny way of being introduced sometimes whenever that they say, well, we don't want people to know that you are a magician. Yeah. And so occasionally that I will be introduced as being a speaker on a particular topic or whatever that the association, you know, has introduced me to be. And I remember one time that I came out and I was saying, okay, well, the first 15, I want to talk about such and such for this first 15 minutes. And then I said, because there have been a lot of changes in legislation, I think it's important that everybody knows. And this, I was a keynote speaker. There were like 2,500 people there.
Sure.
And then I said, it'll take about 15 minutes. And then I'm going to have speak then also about how that impacts companies and what's going to be happening then with the workforce, et cetera, for that 15 minutes. And then beyond that, then and kind of conclude, you know, the last 15 minutes of my 45-minute speech about how this then will directly impact families and what this could do then also to the environment and everything. And about the time I was finished with just that kind of introduction of my agenda, I noticed two or three people trailing out saying, this is not going to be for me. I'm going to the bar, you know. And in the meantime, and I said, but before I begin, you know, most speakers like to begin like with a joke or something. I said, so I did a magic trick, and I had some, you know, some patter going with it that was funny that ended up being a trick. I said, oh, you like magic. Well, let me show you something else. I said, well, let me kind of walk over this way. And I had a stage off to the side and a curtain and everything over there. And I had a table. I pulled a prop out, and I said, "Let me show you something else." And then just kind of, and then realized that, well, hey, wait a minute. If you like that more, we'll just do more of this, and not
all
the other.
All of a sudden, it's captivating.
Completely
it
different.
Completely captivates them on another level.
Yeah,
isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, and I think that that's another way of trying to get in with an audience, certainly, and show the range that you have. I guess kind of what I was getting at over there is that oftentimes that we find that we are employed as a magician because people have seen us in a particular box, like at a restaurant. Let's say a guy's working at a restaurant and say, oh, he's a close-up guy. I'm going to have you come and do close-up. And then it's like, well, I also do stage or comedy or whatever, or that vice versa. If they see you there, then they don't think of you as being a close-up, that you know, sleight of hand or whatever. Or if you're a serious mentalist, they don't know that you're a comedian or whatever you happen to be, and so it's like an actor, I think, in which it's like, well, I can grow a beard, or I can cut my hair, or I can, you know, lose some weight or do whatever, you know, in order to get this part. But they don't think necessarily outside of the box of what they see you, you know, just at this point, you know. So anyhow, I kind of go on and on here for more about 5 minutes, but you get my point. Have you had situations like that?
Well, this is a perfect thing because we tend, however they initially see us, that's what they presume we do. And for years, I was known mainly as a stage magician.
Yes.
And, of course, the stage magician. Now, interestingly enough, obviously, I've developed a range all the way from extreme close-up artistry. 2 weeks ago, I was doing illusions on stage with Arian Black.
Wow.
As illusions.
Yeah.
But this weekend, I was hired primarily as a close-up artist. So the funny thing was is that some of the people who simply saw me here and were introduced to me here were asking me, oh, do you also do stage? That like, do you do any stage magic?
Yeah.
And I had to explain, well, actually, yes. So I was actually very pleased to be able to be hired as primarily a close-up performer for this because I love close-up magic.
And you do so well.
Well, thank you. It focuses on that specific skill set. And as you said, there was a lecture, and we surprised him with a bit of music. And I just love the incredible range, as you said, with acting. An actor can play an entire range of characters. And a skilled magician, the beauty of magic is it does have this full range of possibilities. You know, whether you're the MC, whether you jump up here doing a very serious stage number, or a very playful close-up act.
Yeah.
It's like we're all having fun. You get to be a kid playing all these roles.
I was listening to a podcast with Vince Gilligan, who was the guy who had written and produced and directed the Breaking Bad series. And he had cast the fellow as Walter White, whose name escapes me right now. Darn it, everybody else knows who this is. And
because he had been working with the X-Files, he saw him as this serious character. And so he wanted to, and when he had this part, then he put him in this position. Well, one of the other guys who was making a decision, I guess, with the studio was saying, well, he's not a serious guy because they just saw him with Malcolm in the Middle. He was the father.
He
said he's a comedy guy.
He's a comedy guy.
He said, how can he play something serious, you know, in Breaking Bad? Said, I know, I've seen him in this kind of, I saw it in his eyes, I knew what he can do. And it's like, of course, he has this kind of range. People just don't realize what you can do sometimes.
I don't know if you've seen it, but Robert De Niro playing the part of this, let's say, a gay pirate, a gay space pirate in Stardust.
No.
The movie Stardust was astonishing. The role that Robert De Niro played, and if you only saw him in that role, you would never be able to imagine that here's this incredible, I mean, one of the grand actors of his generation, who's played some very, very intense, powerful parts, but he's totally flip-flopped and played this complete, totally silly character.
Yeah, and, you know, did you see Robert De Niro also playing in some of these comedies who have been, again, like you say, the Godfather or whatever else, and he's been some very serious roles
whatever
else, and then he is also trying to, you know, now being like Meet the Fockers or, you know, different, really.
Just totally silly. And Dustin Hoffman the same way.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. I think that's one of the beauties of magic, is that we don't have to get pigeonholed. As the classic quote of Robert Houdin is, the magician is an actor playing the part of a magician.
But how do you go about trying to tell your potential booking audience or your corporate client, whoever it is, I also can do this, this, and this?
It's often the hard thing.
Yeah.
No, you said that. That was exactly it. And even with for agents, they want to pigeonhole you. They want to say, oh, you're a close-up magician.
Yes.
And if I say, well, I do close-up and stage and illusions and I can MC and then guess what, I can also sing, somehow they immediately imagine that I'm not a master of any. Oh, so you just can't decide what you want to do. It's like, no, actually, I'm pretty good at all of these.
Yeah, they don't recognize that you have those kinds of skills and everything. Well, that's true.
Yeah. And actually, sometimes it goes against, you know, it works against me.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I have to be very careful not to.
I hadn't thought about that. That can be.
I have to often say, this is what I do. Mm-hmm. And if I say, well, I can also MC, they're a bit dubious about, okay, well, are you an MC?
Yeah, or are you a stage
or guy? Are you a close-up magician?
Yeah.
I can do both. And then there's a moment of, well, no, what do you really do?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. That's what I understand.
Yeah.
So you need to define your own character, know who you are if you want to try to book yourself. You know, I often think that something is bad whenever that somebody is trying to book themselves and they on their business card says birthday parties and bar mitzvahs and corporate parties and funerals or whatever, you know, I mean, like everything. I mean, sure, everybody can do a little bit of everything, and there again, you become a jack of all trades, but then you become nothing more than just a little bit above.
Well, that perception of master of none is false in a lot of people's, in the case of a lot of people. There are a number of us who have mastered a whole range of these, partly because of years of experience, but partly because we've had to.
Yeah.
You know, as a working pro early on, I often say, when the phone rings and they have a check and they've got the money, you say yes.
Yeah.
And it's by saying yes over and over
I heard
and
that about
over
Doug
and taking the gigs and taking the gigs. And if you're willing to keep learning and keep mastering, you know, you can master an incredible range of the
skills.
The skills of the magical performing arts.
I remember hearing a story about Doug Henning. Whenever he had been contacted, and Axon said that we would like to have this television special, but can you? We want you to do the Houdini's water torture escape. Can you do that? He said yes. And
yes.
I said, fine, you're signed.
Say
yes. And then he called Charlie Reynolds the next phone call.
How do we do this?
I don't know how to do this. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And often it's that necessity that forces you to push those boundaries.
Mm-hmm. You think that's a good or bad thing?
It's an individual thing. I think it depends on the individual. Some people are not ready to take on that challenge.
Yeah.
Some of us, it's good to be challenged. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the most amazing natural expansions of our abilities come when we're forced. We're forced to that challenge. We're faced with that.
Mm-hmm.
We have no choice. You have to.
When you put out a fire, basically.
Have to grow.
Yeah.
I mean, the beauty, again, I come back to the beauty of the art of magic, is there's always room for growth. And no matter where we are on the ladder, It's all about reaching for the next rung.
And of course,
it's reaching
creativity
for that.
Too.
Yes.
You know, because you have to dig deep and find that, you know, within you, I think.
I think it's easy to sit within your comfort zone.
Yeah,
but
ways.
With that comes complacency.
Yeah.
And then comes boredom. And I'm often asked, well, how do you keep this excitement and fire and the energy on stage?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm always pushing myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always, they say, I just did this illusion thing with Ariane at the Sandusky Magic Festival.
Yeah.
Neither one of us had ever done illusions together. And we just said, well, why not? We've done them with others. Well, let's go for this.
Sure.
And as two pros, you know, we said, well, let's dive in and create something we've never done. And it was outside each of our comfort zone, and yet by taking the challenge, we rose to that challenge.
There's some people who have perfected something. Let's say like Mr. Electric took the thing around the world as made.
That was
there, you
his
know,
act. Exactly.
Yeah. And I can't say he's complacent, you know.
No.
But he was satisfied with the success and the level of the show and what he has done. Until he finally retired the act and worked it for 50 years or however long, you know. And others, I think, it's not a bad thing. And I don't say, again, that they're complacent. I think that they don't have time to try to work something else because they know that this is a proven formula that works and it's booking, so why should I change that?
It's an individual thing. Exactly. I said for some, that's the idea, for some who need a level of constant growth.
Mm-hmm.
You can take the challenge. Some people
I guess
are very
that's what
happy.
You're looking for. If you want to be,
yeah.
If you're looking for a creative outlet, and it's like, okay, well, I'm good with that. I've done that. I'm going to move on to something else
right.
And go in a different direction. Or those who are saying, oh, hey, look, I'm going to just work this and work it and make
absolutely.
As much as I can.
Perfect
with this.
An 8-minute act, and that'll keep you, you know, working for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And magic has both of those opportunities.
Right. Interesting. Well, Jay, thanks very much. Real quickly before we go, that the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. So. What is your magic word? What is your philosophy of life? What's important to you?
Oh, my philosophy of life?
Yeah.
Wow, how long do we have?
Well, I mean, like I asked Steve Daling, he said buffet, you know.
I'll close it. How about this? The magician opens up our eyes to the wonders all around us, using coins, cards, rings, and silks to inspire and astound us. Now, some may say it's just a trick, but I suggest this strong appeal. The effects may be illusion, but the experience is real.
We'll just put a period at the end of that.
That's
say,
it.
Thank
yes.
you. That's great.
My pleasure. Wonderful. Great talking.
Thank you very much.
And
that was Jay Scott Berry.
I want to say that I'm a big fan of Scott Berry, Jay, and I'm just really happy to... I've had a cocktail. I'm sorry. I'm just a big fan. Thank you, Mr. Wells Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Daly, Steve, for the Magic Word Podcast. That was Jay Scott Berry and Steve Daly.
Steve Daly.
That's right. This is Scotty out.